A one, followed by nine zeros, and then the name Wells Fargo, a consumer abuse fine to concentrate the mind. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Friday today, the 20th of April. Glad as always to have you with us, everybody. There are two counts in the corporate malfeasance settlement the government has imposed on Wells Fargo. Misconduct in both its car and its mortgage lending operations. $1 billion, a lot of money, yes, but only a small percentage of the bank's recent profits. It is also, though, by far the biggest bank fine imposed by the Trump administration, specifically the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, run at the moment by Mick Mulvaney, no fan of the agency he is now in charge of. We called him up to talk things over. Mr. Mulvaney, welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you very much for having me.
I can't be the only guy who read the headlines when this thing leaked last night and said, wait, this is the CFPB doing this fine? How did this come to pass?
We had concurrent jurisdiction over this with the OCC, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, and decided in the last several months to actually work together with them on an enforcement action, something that has been legal for a long time, hasn't been done in a long time, at least not at this level. So we had some jurisdiction over some of the claims. The OCC had some over others, and we just decided to do it together.
Yeah, but the premise of the question, sir, is that the CFPB under Mick Mulvaney has, in your own words, not been extremely active.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I thought you meant the legal structure. No, that's actually not true. All I said is that I wasn't going to push the envelope. We weren't going to try and be overly creative and go after folks who might not be breaking the law. I think anybody who would look at the facts, including those that were admitted by Wells, could tell you that they broke the law. So, no, I've said from the very beginning we were going to enforce the law. That's exactly what we've done today.
About how you're running the place, you said to the House Financial Services Committee the other day, you said, listen, I haven't burned the place down. We're just doing a new way of regulating. What does that mean? What does that look like?
Well, there's a lot of discretion in regulations. Regulations are a lot of times very, very gray. Keep in mind, Congress is pretty sloppy. And I say that having formerly been in Congress. They sort of paint the big picture with a big brush, but don't get down into the details. And they leave that to the administration, to the executive branch. And there's a lot of discretion down at that level, and I'm going to exercise mine differently than my predecessor would have. That means I think I dismissed one lawsuit out of 26. We might not bring as many lawsuits as he did, but that doesn't mean we're not enforcing the law. I'm a bureaucrat now, and that means that my job is to enforce the law, and I'm going to do what the statute tells me to do. But I'm not going to go beyond that. And that's the biggest difference between me and the previous leadership of the Bureau.
But you've delayed enforcement of some rules. You've dropped lawsuits against payday lenders. You've stripped out some protections of fair lending provisions. I guess the question writ large is...
Actually, if I can interrupt, go ahead. I don't think any of that is true. I've dismissed one lawsuit, not lawsuits. We haven't. The only thing we changed at fair lending was to... bifurcated. Fair lending has two functions. They have a supervision and enforcement function. That is one. And they have an education function. Within the structure of the Bureau, those two functions are performed in two different places. So instead of leaving it together in the Office of Fair Lending, we simply put part of it in supervision and enforcement, part in education. Have not changed the actual operations of what we're doing at all.
Fair enough. Let me ask the question directly to the point that many of the critics of what you're doing in the Bureau have to say, which is, do you believe there is a place for consumer protection in the government?
Yes. And I think I've said that. I'm happy to say that. Yes, I absolutely do. Especially when it comes to federal enforcement over federal entities. I'm all for changing the Bureau. Don't get me wrong. But that has as much to do with the power that's given to me as an individual as it is with the way we protect consumers.
So since you pointed out that you are a bureaucrat now, sir, you are the rare bureaucrat in Washington. And I say this without meaning anything pejorative about the people who work in this government who do noble service. But you're the rare one who says, I have too much power.
Yeah, well, this is the way I explain it to people. If you don't like what I did today, let's say that you're Wells Fargo and you think that I was unfair. Conversely, let's say you're in a consumer group and you don't think we were harsh enough on Wells Fargo. There's no elected official that you can complain to, not your congressman, not your senator, not the president of the United States, nobody. I don't answer to anybody. I honestly don't think that's fair. I have a tremendous amount of discretion as to who we sue, who we don't sue, what lawsuits we might dismiss. If you don't like that, then you need to change the statute to take that authority away from me, and I think that should be done.
Do you think there's no merit to consumer protection being insulated from the political winds in Washington?
I don't know what that means.
That means, sir, that Congress runs hot and cold depending on who's in power and who's not. And one would hope that one would have a consistent regulatory framework where consumer financial interests could be protected.
Absolutely agree, which is why I think you have to change the structure of what they built. Ask your question right now. Do you think we're giving a consistent regulatory structure under Richard Cordray's leadership and then mine? Or is that going to be a dramatic swing from one to the other? We are not like the other regulatory agencies right now. We are sort of associated with Elizabeth Warren, and that's not right. We need to be a regulator, not somebody's, child.
Quick change of gears. Let me ask you to put on your director of the Office of Management and Budget hat. And I'm not going to ask you to answer for Secretary Mnuchin and his statement the other day that these tax cuts are going to pay for themselves. But I do want to ask you about the report out from the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, also a projection by the International Monetary Fund, saying that the Trump tax cuts are going to boost growth in this economy substantially in the short term, 3.3% or more.
Correct.
But then they both say that growth is going to fall off to 1.9%, which is not going to get you the growth you need to get these tax cuts to pay for themselves. How do you respond?
That has been the CBO's baseline number for the last several years, going back, I think, 3 or 4 years into the middle of the Obama administration. The CBO believes that the new normal, that the baseline growth of the American economy is going to be roughly 1.8-1.9%. And what we're saying is that, no, we have fundamentally changed the structure of the economy, that the deregulatory policies, the energy policies, and most importantly, the tax policy have fundamentally changed the economy in the United States so that that 3% growth will be sustainable.
And you just believe that. That's what you say.
Productivity comes from businesses investing in their workers. And that's the fundamental change that we made in the tax bill. We made it more profitable for businesses to invest. And that's why we think this is a structural change and not just a short-term sugar high that might come, say, from a marginal rate reduction by itself.
Last question, sir, and then I'll get out of your hair. How long are you going to be doing these two jobs? Because it seems to me they're both full-time or more.
Until I have hair left. They are. But I do like them. The president and I were joking about that this weekend. I don't know. As long as he wants me to, I think I'm barred by statute to be at the Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection beyond June 22nd, unless they make a permanent nomination to the Senate before then. So I wouldn't expect that I'm at the Bureau longer than the end of this calendar year.
Mick Mulvaney, he runs the Office of Management and Budget, and also temporarily anyway, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Mr. Mulvaney, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
It's a true pleasure. Thanks for having me.
On Wall Street today, not so great big picture, but Wells Fargo investors had themselves a little bit of a relief rally. Actually, shares up almost 2%. Now that the shoe has dropped, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. It is a rare, rare Friday when our weekly wrap isn't the first thing in the program, but $1 billion in bank fines and the guy who levied at least part of those fines would seem to qualify. The week, however, is not going to wrap itself up. David Gura is with MSNBC. Anna Swanson is with The New York Times. They are both in our bureau in New York. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, David, let me ask you this. That thing that Mr. Mulvaney said about fundamentally restructuring the economy, which is an amazing achievement for 14 months of a presidential administration. You buying it?
He was being pretty facetious there. He called himself a bureaucrat. In fact, Mick Mulvaney is a political appointee, one who didn't have to get confirmed by Congress to do the job that he's doing now. He said he isn't being overly creative when it comes to regulation. He is certainly being creative when it comes to how he's running this agency, a point that he made over and over again in that interview, just bringing to light the fact, something that he's complained a lot about when he was in Congress, that is, he doesn't like the way that bureaucracy is structured. He thinks that there should be a group of regulators running it, like the SEC. He thinks there needs to be more oversight. Real quickly here, I mean, the AP had a story just a few days ago about how many political appointees he's made at the Bureau, how much they're being paid. He is doing things deliberately to raise the ire of Congress with the hope, I think, that they'll change what was codified, what was a part of that consumer protection law.
Right. Anna, let me change gears here and also point out that you're in Washington, not New York, so that was my bad. I want to play a piece of tape from Christine Lagarde, who runs the International Monetary Fund. Guys, it's going to be the second cut of Lagarde, talking about the tax plan and what it's going to mean for American growth, and then we're going to play it. Here she is, Christine Lagarde, the head of the IMF.
At the same time, we are concerned about the deficit. We are concerned about the debt of the United States. And we know that because of aging, because of entitlement, these will come to haunt the American economy and the American people.
Anna, one thing I didn't get to with Mr. Mulvaney was this idea that the tax plan has been deficit financed. The budget deal of 6 weeks ago was $1 trillion plus, and much of that in the red. There is a whole nother part of this thing that, besides the growth not matching it, actually will come to pass in the out years.
Yeah, absolutely. So Mulvaney was saying that the administration has fundamentally restructured the economy, and you've seen a lot of claims, you know, in recent months that these tax cuts will pay for themselves. But it's pretty clear that what the IMF is saying is that the Trump tax cuts are more of a sugar high than a long-term productivity boost. And, you know, they do anticipate U.S. growth to rise in the next couple of years because of the tax cut, but then they see it falling back again. And that creates bigger worries about the ultimate deficit. The IMF has really urged countries that, you know, in these good times, they need to be paying down their debt, not increasing it. And they do see the tax cuts as doing that.
Yeah. Anna, let me stay with you, actually. And I want to turn to trade for a minute, because we learned this week, once again, that the president doesn't care for TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, despite earlier comment that maybe he does. Psych. Well, I mean, come on, right? But also, I want to talk about NAFTA, Anna, and where things stand with that. And you know, the Congress is going to have to pass this thing if and when it gets done. It's seeming more precarious by the day, I guess, is the point.
Yeah. So right now, negotiators are basically, you know, working full time. The top level guys are meeting today. Right now, actually, we're expecting an announcement later today. And then lower level people will be meeting through the weekend. Higher level officials meeting again next week. So they are really racing to meet this deadline they've been talking about early May. But there's still a lot of different ideas on the table. You know, that isn't necessarily unusual. People who have covered past trade negotiations tell me that, you know, everything tends to happen at the last minute. There's kind of a lot of horse trading. But as you mentioned, even if you get over that first hurdle, you know, finding a deal that Canada and Mexico will accept, you still need to pass it through Congress, which means you need to get either congressional Republicans who don't like the trade agendas to support it, or Democrats who don't really like Mr. Trump to vote for it.
Yeah. David, last whack goes to you in the 45-ish seconds we've got left. So brace yourself. The president, now more than ever, especially after this week with Shinzo Abe, the prime minister of Japan in Florida, seems bound and determined to do bilateral trade, not multilateral, despite the benefits of multilateral trade deals.
Yeah, I checked my phone while you were talking about whether or not he supported the TPP because it changes so much. I mean, I am just confounded by his perspective on multilateralism. On the campaign trail, of course, Donald Trump was so vehemently anti-multilateralist. And now he's talking about going back to it. Of course, we had the Syria strike to get out of the economic realm. He assembled a coalition for that. You know, I'm confused by what he wants to do. It was a moment that stood out to me during that press conference at Mar-a-Lago, the president's house in Florida, when he was next to Shinzo Abe and announced that they hadn't come to an agreement on a trade deal. Of course, Shinzo Abe trying to bring him back into the TPP. I think that we're just as confused as we have been on what this White House's stance is on trade. And Anna's got her work cut out for her. She's doing this day to day. That's a busy weekend ahead of her.
David Gura, he's a weekend anchor on MSNBC. Anna Swanson covers global trade for the New York Times. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Thank you.
All right, have a nice weekend. As Mick Mulvaney was saying, the big Wells Fargo fine today was a joint decision. $1 billion imposed 50-50 by two different government agencies, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, which regulates banks, and Mr. Mulvaney's Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Now, $1 billion is, as I said, a whole lot of money. Who gets it? Marketplace's Kimberly Adams is on that one.
That $1 billion penalty gets split in half. $500 million for the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, or OCC, which goes into the general fund at the Treasury. And
the fine paid to the CFPB goes into what's called their Civil Penalties Fund. And this is a general fund that's used to pay out consumers who have been impacted in this case or in other cases.
Aaron Lockwood studies financial regulations at the University of California, Irvine. The fine is big enough for Wells Fargo to adjust its first quarter profit estimates down $800 million. But, says Lockwood,
on the other hand, Wells Fargo and many other large banks have been making record profits.
But the fine isn't the only way this deal is making Wells Fargo pay up. Dan Stepano spent decades at the OCC and is now with the law firm Buckley Sandler.
There's the civil money penalty aspect of it, which is designed to provide punishment to the institution and deterrence. And then there's the restitution piece, which is how the customers get made whole.
And the money to pay that restitution is in addition to the fine. Aaron Klein is a fellow at the Brookings Institution.
Ironically, the larger the fine, the less the American public thinks the system is working, because the banks seem to be able to pay it and keep doing what they were doing anyways.
He says these kinds of fines might hit shareholders and banks a bit, but they aren't enough to restore public trust. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Coming up,
I think all of a sudden the markets realized that the current housing stock wasn't meeting what they were looking for.
Build, baby, build. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 201 points today, 0.8%, closed at 24,462. NASDAQ shed 91 points, 1.2%, 71.46. S&P 500 gave back 22, 0.8%, 26.70 there. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow up 0.4%, NASDAQ rallied 0.6% higher, S&P 500 appreciated about 0.5%. Tech was a little troubled today. Apple wilted 4% on concerns about falling iPhone sales. Toymaker Mattel flopped 3.6% today on news its CEO is stepping down. Mattel and a whole bunch of other toy makers are still hurting from the closure of all those Toys R Us stores. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.96%. Pay attention to bonds, peeps. You're listening to Marketplace. Just as you count on Marketplace for reliable, in-depth news and information, we are counting on listeners like you to invest in what we do. The more people who support Marketplace, the more we can do to raise economic intelligence across this country. You'll reap the rewards every time you listen, knowing that you're helping Marketplace make people smarter about the economy and why it matters. And don't forget, your donation will be matched dollar for dollar when you give today, thanks to a generous challenge from our friends at Candida. Now's the time, folks. Go to Marketplace.org and make a gift to become a Marketplace investor today.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Don't know if you've noticed, but the president's tweets have taken a decided turn toward the markets of late. Not the stock market, because, well, stocks go down too, right? But toward various asset classes is probably a better way to put it. He was all about foreign exchange the other day, China and Russia and currency manipulation. Today it was oil. OPEC is at it again, he tweeted this morning. Oil prices are artificially very high, exclamation point, with assorted irregular capitalization for emphasis. I mean, sure, it's convenient to blame somebody for high gas prices, but the story beyond 280 characters is that there is something bigger happening to the global oil market. Scott Tong has that one from the Sustainability Desk.
The president blames OPEC for high oil prices. He tweeted that there's oil all over the place. That's true, or at least there was a glut 3 years ago. Longtime energy analyst Daniel Yergin is vice chairman at IHS Market.
The glut is mostly gone. It's been largely worn down by the factors of a strong world economy.
In other words, demand is surging in places like China.
And the fact that Saudi Arabia and Russia have found a new platform for cooperation.
They're hooking up to hold down supply. added up, and the crude reality is we're at a rough balance now between supply and demand after years of too much oil. One other thing jacking up prices is U.S. policies of boycotting or threatening to boycott key petrostates, says Herman Wang at S&P Global Platts.
The reason that oil prices are higher right now is because of actions that the U.S. White House is doing, threatening to walk away from the Iran deal, sanctions on Venezuela, sanctions on Russia.
The Russians and OPEC have restricted supply for 2 years now. And today at an oil producers meeting in Saudi Arabia, they pledged to keep doing it and to keep prices up. Here's energy analyst Ellen Wald at Transversal Consulting.
They're very satisfied with how their production cuts are going, and they don't want to change anything. Even if they're not saying $80 a barrel, that may be kind of their ideal target.
That translates very roughly to another 15 cents a gallon here in the States, just in time for that summer drive. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
There was a thing you saw a lot of if you spent time in some of the medium-sized to big cities in this country during the recession. Upscale apartment buildings clearly still under construction, but also clearly completely abandoned, or brand new buildings that were half empty. Sometimes it was the developers had run out of money midstream. Sometimes rising unemployment made potential renters unwilling or even unable to shell out for shiny new digs with all the conveniences. These days, there are still half-built apartment complexes out there, but for just the opposite reason, builders can't get them up fast enough, banking on upscale workers who want a slice of urban living. But in some of those cities, developers are learning that just because they have built it, might be a while before the renters come. From WESA in Pittsburgh, Marketplace's Erica Barris looks at what's happening in her city.
Pittsburgh's East End is home to some of the country's best-known universities and tech companies. It's also a construction zone. High-end apartment buildings are going up all over the place. Signs tout their amenities, pools, gyms, rooftop decks, and lately, 1 or 2 months, free rent.
I have passed by apartments where the doors are open and, like, it's empty, so I don't think they're full.
That's Yasmin Dalsimer. She's talking about Bakery Square, where she and her husband Sam rent a one-bedroom. Sam and Yasmin are in their early 30s. She's in education. He's in tech. They came to Pittsburgh last year from New York after their rent passed the $3,000 a month mark.
Like, over 60% of my salary was going toward me just having a place to live in.
But Bakery Square, with its generic modern aesthetic, boxy with lots of glass, wasn't exactly what they had in mind.
My first reaction was, no, we're not living here. This is not real, authentic Pittsburgh. This feels very artificial and newly constructed.
The thing is, this is the Pittsburgh that's been constructed for people like the Dalsimers, young and techie. More than 12,000 transplants have flooded the city in the past several years to work at places like Uber and Google and in the healthcare industry.
I think all of a sudden the markets realized that the current housing stock wasn't meeting what they were looking for.
That's Christopher Bream, a regional economist at the University of Pittsburgh. That housing stock he's referring to, dated apartments in older, neglected buildings, hundreds and hundreds of them. After decades of population decline and stalled development, developers were eager to answer the call for something better.
There's sort of a latent demand that wasn't being met for some of these apartments, but that doesn't mean that developers weren't want to sort of overbuild.
At last count, the vacancy rates for luxury apartments was around 11%, and thousands more units are being built, many in neighborhoods where low-income residents are being pushed out. Driving past a row of new empty storefronts, Sam Dalsimer says the situation is a constant topic of conversation.
You know, are we a force for good or bad in this neighborhood? You know, we realize that we're a part of this process of gentrification that's happening here.
And many of those new apartments, where a one-bedroom goes for around $1,700 a month, could go unrented because of another economic reality of the new Pittsburgh. It has a tech workforce without the typical punishing tech real estate market, meaning rents are still low enough to make it possible for young workers to save money, and homes are still affordable. Take Jisoo Sun, who came to Pittsburgh for college and stayed for a tech career.
I saw that my rent was very close to what my mortgage would be, potential mortgage. I was like, I should buy a house.
So she did. A three-bedroom for just under $400,000. That's at the higher end. The median home price in Pittsburgh is around $150,000. But compared to her hometown in Northern California,
my house probably in San Francisco would cost $3 to $4 million, and I don't know many 27-year-olds that could afford that.
Hans Norby, an analyst with CoStar Group, says Pittsburgh, along with some places like Kansas City and Charlotte, may be experiencing a glut of apartments for the short term, but they're likely to catch up to places like Tampa and Seattle, where the markets are tight.
And we've got a lot of young professionals moving to these cities, which also supports a Class A 4 or 5-star renter for some time.
In the meantime, says Norby, renters should enjoy the amenities arms race.
It'll be a good time to be a luxury apartment renter in Pittsburgh for the next year, because supply is going to be high in 2018.
Sam and Yasmin Dalsimer, though, will be doing their part to make it even higher. They just bought a house for $333,000. And when they move, they'll be leaving behind another empty apartment. In Pittsburgh, I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a call back to the IMF report that I was talking to Anna and David about, also Mick Mulvaney, for that matter. Along with its projections of global growth, it also tallied up global debt, how much we all owe collectively, governments, household companies, the whole smash. $164 trillion is the number, which, first of all, yes, is basically funny money. It's so much. But also, you got to remember this. One person's debt is another person's asset. Oh, it's going to be tight. I'll just give them the weeklies. How about that? For the week, the Dow up 0.4%, NASDAQ up 0.6%, S&P 500 up about 0.5%. Theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. The executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.